that we are really didn't get a good chance to introduce the discussion because we had to rush hour and we could talk before we had to leave. But I wanted to welcome some of you whose faces I recognize from previous sessions that we've had with the Church of Biologics, and also welcome those of you who have never attended one. This part of the Drugs and Biologics breakout for the past number of years has been sort of dedicated to CMC in general and quality by design specifically. In the past 3 years, I think now, we've had Ari Ahnan, who has come in and really helped us drill down into the basics and build on those basics and challenge us in our thinking in trying to bring quality by design through quality by design into pharma. And we spoke a little bit last year about Joe Duran and his quality by design, and he also touched on Deming a little bit last year as well. So this year we're going to be delving into Deming, and we're very fortunate. It's been a bit of a roller coaster. We had actually several different speakers who were supposed to be speaking in this session. We're going to have Kevin Cahill, who is Deming's grandson. He unfortunately had an accident earlier in the year and wasn't able to make it, but he was very gracious and introduced us to Dr. Bill Bellows, who's going to be our next speaker. And Bill is actually on the Deming Institute Board of Directors. He works with Pratt and Rocketdyne, and he is an evangelist in my eyes for Deming's philosophy and Deming principles. So I think we'll be able to get a lot of good information out of him. We're also going to have a little fun. He's going to give us a little exercise. That's why you have these interesting pieces of paper on your table. And after that, we're going to have a discussion by Trish Flaherty. She's going to actually be going into the case studies that are using Deming tonight. So without any further ado, I'd like to go ahead and bring Bill on up. One thing that Bill does is he actually does a 9-hour seminar over 2 days on trying to think differently and using Deming's principles in business. And he's very skilled in engineering, being in rocket building. He works with rocket engines, so he could be a fan of it. He is a rocket scientist. So without further ado, let's go ahead and bring Bill on.
Thank you, Cindy. All right, as Cindy mentioned, this is a 9-hour seminar that I offer. There's no fee to attend. You just have to drive to Canoga Park. That's the catch. And if you're not aware, Canoga Park is about 40 miles northwest of LAX. And so the material I'm presenting is borrowed from that 9-hour seminar. The work I've been doing for the last 20-some years, and I met Dr. Deming in 1990. But prior to that, I got exposed to quality improvement. Actually, I got exposed because I got involved in a training in problem solving and decision making material from the Charles Kettner and Ben Trago interview. Second training. Okay. So I became a certified instructor in problem-solving decision-making and worked in engineering in Connecticut, in Stratford, Connecticut. And part of the strategy was that I would be involved in delivering the training and then being the expert in engineering whenever there were issues, which was 2 or 3 times a year. We made tank engines. We made a lot of tank engines, 120 a month. So at least once or twice a year, the Army would stop receiving tank engines for the Abrams battle tank because of issues, and so I got exposed to being involved in when things were broke. And so this remark has to do with more than Dr. Deming's work. The title is A Thousand Points of Light. And part of what I had in mind is it's not just Deming's 14 points. What I'm hoping to get across here is there's a lot. What I'm hoping to get across is enough that you really appreciate better that the 14 points are not just 14 points. I think most people hear the 14 points, they apply them to how they currently think, which means nothing really changes. And so I'd like you to think about the 14 points which I'll present in terms of a bunch of other content which is going to come at you in a way you haven't seen before. And feel free to interrupt at any time. And this chart will follow at the end, and you can then get a chance, if you didn't catch this now, to get my address and contact info. So, there we go. So I've broken it into these sections, taken together and some background on Demings and some insights, and then models, micro and macro, in thinking and reflective organizations, and that's where the trip report comes in. So there'll be a point that I'll ask you to imagine what it would have been like if you actually visited those two organizations. These are two extreme organizations. And the premise is that you've each recently visited both of those organizations for 2 weeks each, and what goes in those four cells are what you would have seen when you visited. So as I'm going through the remarks, you can be thinking about that. And then the top two cells have to do with, in the 2 weeks you visited both organizations, the premise is for the first week there was no one there but you. So as you walk around the organization, all you can do is drop down aspects of the physical environment. Right? The bottom two cells, the premise is for the second week you're there, there are people there. So for the second week, you tell me about the people of both organizations. So the top two cells are the first week, it's just what does it look like as you walk around. The bottom two cells are what are the people like. And I'll just, as we go through the material, you'll see how that applies to what these organizations are like. And then we'll get into modes of thinking. And the modes of thinking explain, why organizations do what they do. We're unaware, fundamentally unaware of our thinking. We're in reaction all the time. We're not thinking about our thinking. We're thinking, we're just not aware. We're just focusing on action. And that's why I refer to it as reflexes. Dr. Demings said, pulling your hand off of a hot stove does not require anything. It's all reflexes. And so reflexive organizations are filled with people who are not thinking about their thinking. They're all in reaction. And in-thinking organizations are filled with people who are aware of their thinking, but also take action. So it's not only thinking, there's also action. But in a reflexive organization, it's all action, no awareness of thinking. And then we'll look at the present state organizations and then what might each organization look like with its awareness. So the model I work with at Rocketdyne is what would happen if individuals became aware of their thinking? It would evolve the way we work together, to start out in pairs. It evolves the way those two people begin to learn together. And if things go right, then what others are doing will be influenced by what those first people did. So it starts to spread across the organization. And the next thing you know, there's more people becoming aware. This is February 1990. That's Dr. Deming. This guy over here, Doug Fox, is the one Dr. Deming corresponded with to appear at Western Connecticut State University. And if you're interested, there's Dr. Deming spoke three times that day. He spoke at 1 o'clock to the students, 2 o'clock to the faculty. Then that evening, he spoke to the general public. And that evening video, you can find on Vimeo. So if you went to Vimeo.com and searched for Fellows Deming, you'll find the hour and a half lecture that evening with an opening remark by Doug Fox. And I'll also point out So Fox gave it a video. By the time I posted the VHS copy, I'd played it many times. So the sound is really good, but the screen behind Dr. Deming, I have a hard time seeing. But everything he writes on the screen, handwritten, and all the notes he's pulling from ViewGraph, come from the book that he was writing at the time. So I recommend people, if you watch the video, then read the book and go back and forth. I mean, those notes you can't read are almost word for word in here. Okay. So you'll appreciate, I mentioned that at the time I was working for Half-Life Plumbing and Traffic Connecticut, and we were making 120 views a month for the Army. And for the last 23 years, I've been working in another part for Rocketdyne, and our biggest product as a space element into them out of production after 30 years of production. Is the R-68 engine, which stands 18 feet tall, the nozzle is 8 feet diameter. And the major use of this engine is strapped on three different cores, side by side, with both three common cores of a vehicle called Delta IV, made by United Launch Alliance in Decatur, Alabama. And each of these engines produces 650,000 pounds of thrust, and so, so side by side together is three times that. And so the primary role of this engine is launching what? Not only satellites, but really heavy satellites. And the type of satellites that like to eavesdrop on people. These are $20,000 spy satellites. A 20,000 pound, billion-dollar spy satellite. This engine is primarily, the main use of this engine is putting spy satellites into orbit for the National Reconnaissance Office. And when I talk to organizations, this is not what organizations, how organizations look at products. They look at them as what? A bunch of parts. Not only a bunch of parts, but a bunch of parts that fly in close formation. They're actually not connected. And then what I want to point out is our thinking allows us to do this. Our thinking sees things as parts, not in relationship. We see things as parts. So that what we provide our customers were parts that were in a box and stayed in a box, then there wouldn't be anything wrong. But if the parts are actually part of something, they actually have to connect, then there's something wrong with how we run organizations. But our organizations see things like this. Okay. The vertical axis, we'll come back to this chart at the end, but not only am I pointing out at the beginning that organizations manage parts, but in terms of the choice of being proactive or reactive, where do you think organizations fall? Yep, down here. And in terms of organizations being about a sense of ours and one for all and all for one versus my department, my money, my, what do you think? Yeah. All right. And so first thing I saw back 3 years ago is, I mean, the problems with all the training I was doing was because I was being called in when there were problems, not when things were going okay. So the first thing I started to notice on these four quadrants is organizations are highly reactive. Then when I looked close, I figured out the territoriality stuff, the silos. And these go hand in hand. You show me an organization that's reactive, I'll show you an organization which is filled with silos. The silos are parts. So what I mean by proactive is applying effort while things are good, while things are well, while things are correct. That's proactive. Reactive is applying effort when things are bad, not okay, going to the doctor when you're sick, or focusing on things that are not correct. And as prevention is worth a pound of cure. I researched this recently. You know who coined that phrase?
Before
Deming. It's Ben Franklin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he was really big on fire safety. Like he invented the lightning rod and purposely didn't patent it. Okay. Efficient Time, page 9. He says that for us. I read this book at the same time. See that? Both quotes were set in the same time frame. The mid to late, actually 1790 time frame. This quote comes from an English sea captain. So those are both examples of being proactive. But you only have the savings if you act before the trouble. So the efficient plan is page 9 only if you act before. And so when we're being reactive, we're missing that leverage. That's a sad thing. At the moment, it's a sad thing. And then another example of investment thinking. Every dollar we invest in high quality or early education can save more than $7 later on. So the problem is, of acting while things are good is, are these types of leverage. Okay. Is that where the last quote comes from? President Obama speaking to the governors back in February. Alright. The macro system model, and I'll come back to this chart later, I'll show you macro and micro. But the macro system model is how organizations currently operate in terms of managing parts. And so in terms of a part focus, the quality focus is conformance to requirements. And so everyone in the organization is given a set of requirements to meet, and their job is to meet the requirements. When they've met the requirements, what do they do with that thing they're working on? Do they hand it off to the next person? And the next person says what? If it meets requirements, what does the next person say? Next person says, thank you. Can the next person say, no? No, the requirements are met, and I hand it off to you, you say, thank you. Okay? And so that's what I mean by managing parts. Then my part is done. Right? My part is done, and then he does his thing and hands it off to the next guy, and he says, thank you. But when I hand off the part which is good, let's say I hand off, see, if I hand it off and it's bad, what does he do? And I get the bad thing. Because it's not good. And then I'll go off and do some things, and I'll hand it to him. And if it's good, what just happens? Okay? I am relieved. I'm done. So if he calls me up an hour later and says, Bill, we have an issue, what do I say? And I said, that's your problem. See what I mean by managing parts? Can you see the silence that was just created? Can you see the separation?
I see everything,
yeah. Do I have any responsibility once he says yes? Do I have any responsibility? None whatsoever. So, I didn't bring it with me, but I used in the 9-hour class just to demonstrate this. This would be like Tom Brady throwing the ball, and so I'm Tom Brady and I throw the ball, and I say that when the ball meets my hand, it has a velocity that meets requirements, a spin that meets requirements, an angle that meets requirements, and I walk off the field because my job is done. And then I walk over to the coach, and the coach says, where are you going? You have to see the ball spot. And I say, well, I don't have to, technically, because I was told by the systems engineers that if I meet my requirements, then I don't have to watch the ball caught. They say, well, about feedback. Well, the only feedback I needed, the part was good. I don't need feedback that the ball was caught. That would be wasteful. This is what we call teamwork. My part was good. This is managing parts. Right, and this is a macro system model. What I'm going to show you later is where this comes from. I had a woman in my office not long ago, and I took the cap off of a water bottle. So I keep the water bottle in my office, never really got into it. And I say, so let's say we decide to have this made by a supplier, and if all the requirements are met, what do we say about it? It's good. And then here we say it is, right? You see the space between them? Flying in close formation. So I said to her, shouldn't we focus on how well it goes on? And she said, it's so cool. She said, but if the requirements are met, then shouldn't it sit? I said, that's the model. She said, that's not right. I said, well, I just want you to realize that what you're repeating back to me is what you're trained to believe. And she said, well, that's not what's going on. I said, no, there's something else going on, but you're missing it. But in the matter of the model, the goal is defect-free part, and then we get around, and the quality folks tell us how much scrap and how much rework. The mindset is reactive. Okay, where does the victim come from? Where does the victim piece come from? Well, as soon as he becomes the victim and I hand off.
Right.
And so the person that has put all this together becomes the victim. Another scenario I've seen is, and actually I'm going to come back to that, but I'll reinforce where the victim comes from. But in a reflective organization, who are the victims? Everyone. In a reflective organization, if you're on the receiving end of anything, you are a victim. So you just play around and just hand it off to the next person, that's okay. So that just perpetuates the whole thing, because if you send it through and it comes back to you, then you have no one to complain to. You're part of the game. So then we get into firefighting, that should become obvious. Problem solving, that should become obvious. Or something else. If we ever achieve zero defects, there would be the impact. There's no improvement in quality after zero defects. So the ambition in a macro system model is that everything is good, and then we're done. But all we're really doing is waiting for the next problem. So there's no rest in that organization, as I'll point out, because as long as we focus on things that are bad, there will be things that are bad. So we end up with momentary rest, but there's no improvement in quality. How do you improve quality if quality is defined by meeting requirements? If everything meets requirements, how do you make that better? So there's no definition of better. Better does not exist in that world. And then I think you can see this. The physical handoff is yours. The mental handoff is an organization filled with that. All right. That's the macro model. Now let's talk about that. Born in 1900. And that makes it easy to figure out where how old he was in a given year, if that's very convenient. He was born on October 14th, 1900. 10 years later, who was born on October 14th, 1910? John Wooden. John Wooden, he was going to 10 years later. So here's Dr. Fox, who was corresponding with Deming, and I met Dr. Fox that night, and then several years later I went back and he gave me all the personal correspondence he gave me in his safe at home. He says, I'd like to thank you for your, this is Deming responding to Dr. Fox, or Professor Fox. I thank you for your kind invitation to speak to your classes. It would please me. It should be, I should be interested not only in your classes, but especially with your teaching in the schools of business, engineering, and psychology. It is necessary to survive. It is necessary for survival to have a change of state from economic rebellion individualism, win-lose, to another kind of economics which I characterize as cooperation, win-win. Everyone wins, not equally, but everyone wins. I wonder how many schools of business perpetuate the current system of management, which has leveled off and a led us to destruction. Change must be made in the school system. The so-called merit system in business, government, education, and the grading of students from toddlers up through the university will, for survival, be abolished. These thoughts form part of the content of my 4-day seminar, List and Close. February 11th, 1989. The problem is to find a date. I have not a day in 1989. Some Tuesday in 1990 might be possible. Right? You must tell me what you think would be a good date. I could come in the morning, date of the day. You could not possibly pay me my fee, which is around $25 a day. I will do this as public service, which is the motive behind my teaching 42 years now at NYU and 5 years at Columbia University of Aberdeen, with appreciation. So Deming was born in Sioux City, Iowa, and in 1904, his father, who was trained as a legal assistant, took the family to Powell, Wyoming, shown here. It's just east of Yellowstone. So if you look at where Yellowstone is, it's just southeast, that's the East Gate entrance area, northwest Wyoming. Named after John Wesley Powell, who was the first American to go down the Colorado River, is a Civil War veteran. And next door, maybe 20 miles southwest of Powell, is another famous town, named after another famous American, and Cody Wyoming. And Deming went to Wild West shows and saw Buffalo Bill Cody. So in Cody was a dam, and that dam there helped create, in this region, the largest water reclamation project in the United States. And the water was used to come into town to raise sugar beets, grow sugar beets, I should say. And I visited the town, I visited that house. It was the second house that Deming's father built. And so, if you go back to the photos, turn of the century when Deming grew up, he would have grown around, and in this town would have seen, you know, during the harvest season, sugar beets everywhere. If you go to Coney now, you'll see trucks carrying sugar beets, you'll see trains hauling them off. So it's the same economy, other than it's mechanized. And what Deming saw growing up was full-page ads in the local paper coming from the customer of the sugar beets, the Great Western Sugar Company in Denver, with advice to farmers on when to plant the beets, when to thin the beets, and when to harvest the beets. And he also saw quilting beets. What Deming saw growing up was cooperation. And I was surprised by it. Went to this house in 1997. Yeah, 97. Knocked on the door, said, "We're from Los Angeles." I went up first, and we're from Los Angeles visiting, researching Deming. And the woman let us in, and they bought the home. They were the third owners of the home, showed us the deed and all that. We spent 3 or 4 hours there. Then we went on to graduate from Yale University in 1928. He's a bachelor's and master's at the University of Wyoming in electrical engineering. He was encouraged to go to Yale. He didn't think he'd go in, but his graduate advisor encouraged him to go in. And then he went on to say he thinks one of the reasons he got in is that the Yale band needed he was a musician, and the band needed a musician, so he got in. So this would be Deming, probably in the 1950s. His last book in economics, one of the many medals he was given, this is him in his home office, which is in the basement. And this photo here was taken from the NBC documentary of Japan Can, Why Can't We, which played in the summer of 1980 and put him on the map big time as, prior to that, he was mentioned in mild manners, statistician and consultant in fiscal studies using sampling plans to help organizations such as AT&T get a feeling for how much dollar value they had in inventory. So even though he went to Japan in 1950 and helped the Japanese, and there was a Deming Prize, he was largely just an unassuming statistician living a few miles from the White House, which is what caught NBC's attention. But how cool is it that the country's in a shambles, and the guy the Japanese credit as being so monumental to their success is a few miles from the White House, and Kevin Cahill, Cindy mentioned, could be here, was there that summer. His family had just moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, and he went back to hang out with his high school friends, and his mother told him that, NBC's interviewing, running this documentary, your grandfather might be featured. And so he was upstairs with Dr. Deming, his wife, and his sister. And for the first hour or so, there was no mention to it. And then they went to a commercial, and they said, then after the commercial, we're going to meet the man who changed Japan. And it didn't hit Kevin until they actually showed it all. And he said, when the show was over, he turned to his grandfather and said, you did all that? And they said they had no idea what he did. He said he was downstairs in the office, had a whiteboard or a chalkboard, and knew he played with numbers, but they didn't know what he did. And he said his response was, but he said, "You did all that." He said, "I played something like I helped." And Kevin said the next day the phone was ringing off the hook, and they would hear him talking to Lee Iacocca and Don Peterson from Ford. And Shuichiro Toyota is the grandson of the founder of Toyota. Toyota won the Deming Prize. Deming Prize ceremony 1991. This is an award given by the American Society for Quality in the United States. There's not a day I don't think about what Dr. Deming meant to us. Deming is the core of our management. Here are the 14 points. Create constitutive purpose. But what he's talking about is constitutive purpose in doing things differently. Not Or that they have a constitutive purpose, but it's not the purpose of the existing system. And I talked to someone recently, quote Dr. Dunning, all organizations need to have constitutive purpose. So what he's talking about is changing what they do and then having conscience. They're not keeping what they're doing. So they have incredible constitutive purpose, but it's all about handoffs. Adopting philosophy, which is about teamwork, seems dependent on inspection, which is quality, and the practice of doing business on price tag alone. That's still in practice. Improves constantly and forever the system of production and service, of institute training on the job, institute leadership, drive out peers, break down barriers. So I gave you some clues to where the barriers come from. Eliminate slogans, expectations, and targets. The impression that I got is that these signs were posted to motivate people, and realized the system was fighting what they wanted to do in the first place. So all the signs are doing is just frustrating them. You eliminate work standards. You eliminate management by objective. Deming was not against management by objective, per se, but his frustration was to give you an objective without the resources to achieve it is an issue. So he said, if you're given a goal without the means to achieve it, he says, one, if it's that easy to achieve, then why aren't you already doing it? So the frustration he saw was that the means to achieve it were not given, and simultaneously, two of you could be given different goals. Like one of you could be the left wrist, and the pulse is going to be 80 beats per minute, and the other one's going to be the right wrist, and it's 90 beats a minute. That's not possible if they're part of the same body. But if they're separated, it is. So part of the frustration was, if the pieces are connected, you cannot independently give everyone a goal. But if they are parts, you can do that. But if they are parts, then there is no teamwork. Okay, remove barriers to rob the hourly worker of pride, of his right to pride and worthership. Remove barriers to rob people in management and engineering of their right to pride and worthership. Institute a vigorous program of education and self-improvement. Put everyone to work, everyone in the company to work to accomplish the transformation is everyone's job. So we'll come back to this list for a moment, that once we go through and you see more of the macro and the micro and the reflexive and the in-thinking, that this becomes clearer and clearer what he was trying to articulate, and yet what people heard was not what he said. And have you ever seen that phenomenon, that what somebody tells you is not what you heard? Then the response is that you need to have your hearing checked. Okay. Insights. Okay. So my focus, looking at what Deming was talking about, that kind of Deming's work in an organization which is highly reactive, which I thought was not a good way to run a company. Because what you're saying is you're constantly in firefighting mode. And in the business we're in, where NASA comes up and gives us a contract for hundreds of millions of dollars to build a space shuttle manned engine, to develop it, they say, here, you can make this. But who owns the design? The government owns the design. And so what happens is, if there's a problem, which there are, and it goes on for so long, what does NASA do? NASA says, we appreciate your efforts, but we're going to find someone else to do this. And so I saw that going on, and it worked. You know, we have problems, and you're trying to solve it quickly before NASA says, here, we're going to take that work away from you and find another contractor who's really hungry. And so they're going to go to the same site. So it still ends up coming back, their home. My focus is, what is our thinking that causes all this to happen? And my retractors who work closely with them, he says, what we see depends on what we thought before we looked. Alright, so, I live in Santa Clarita,
somewhere over here,
and we're way down here. New Kunama, a real place, is somewhere over here. And I drove through there once on the way to San Francisco. And found this sign. Population, the sign was put in 562, 2150 feet above sea level, established in 1951. And that's a real sign. It's a real sign. I've seen it. So you can add them up. So what I think is scarier than you can add the numbers, how many of you work in companies where the 4663 will be used to make a decision? And you're going to try and fight that, and you're going to say, but wait a minute, the decision is based on that. Just bite your tongue. Alright. Tom Johnson has visited Rockdown a few times. How the world we perceive works depends on how we think. The world we perceive is the world we bring forth through our thinking. And in an in-thinking organization, that is understood. In a reflexive organization, it's just not understood at all. It's just, Alright. What's the leading use of alligators in the United States today? Shoes? No. Boots? No. Leading use? Right there. Holding alligators together. The leading use of alligators in the United States today. Now, Dr. Deming would say all knowledge is temporal, which means all knowledge is time-dependent. So when alligators are extinct, which is just a matter of time, then, living use might be handbags. All right. Arnold Palmer, you've heard of him? You know who his favorite drink is? He was at the Masters a few months ago, and somebody asked the waitress what he ordered. And she had a waitress open, whatever, she said, he said, I'll have a Mr. Palmer. So how do you make an Arnold Palmer? Okay, but how would you make it then? See it? Right, so you start with what? You have lemonade and iced tea, then what? In what? In a glass, okay. So I was in a restaurant in Huntington Beach, years ago, and I ordered an Arnold Palmer, because somebody told me 2 years earlier that there's actually a drink. Someone ordered it by half iced tea and half lemonade, and somebody said there's actually a name for it. It's called an Arnold Palmer. And I find that most waiters and waitresses, if you order it half and half, they'll say, oh, you mean an Arnold Palmer. Most of them know. So I ordered an Arnold Palmer, and this is what the waitress brought me. She put it down in front of me, and what's funny, so she put it down in front of me, what does it look like? Well, it's advising with a lemon, but she puts it down in front of me, and they're like, this is at the table. She puts it down in front of me and says to me, this is the iced tea, the bar doesn't serve lemonade. Where did I sit? I said, I don't know what that means. It just doesn't make any sense to me. This is when it makes sense. When she came back with a glass of lemonade, then I realized what she had said. That the bar and the restaurant were separate. So the Arnold Palmer was served in two glasses with two straws. And then she walked away. And fortunately, somebody had a camera. I mean, this was not staged. But when she brought it up and said, did the bar serve like you got lemonade? I'm thinking, I didn't say what, it just didn't make any sense to me. But 2 minutes later, she came out with the lemonade, I just started to laugh, I thought, oh my God, I now know what you said. Here's your satellite, here's your rocket. How much time was spent discussing parts that are good that are right on time? I've asked that question of many audience, and I'll ask it places they start laughing. Right, so everywhere I've gone, the answer to that question is zero. In fact, quite often people will do that, so they can really emphasize the zero and do one of these. So the proposal is, if the answer is zero, my proposal is that your thinking must be, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Sound good? So I'm just trying to say, that's the thinking behind the answer. Okay, now what I want you to do is say, if you're driving your car and the thinking is if it's not broken, don't fix it, when will you put gas in it? When? When it runs out. Because someone will say, let's get gas, and you'll say, But it's good. That's good to ask. But it's worth it. Alright. And so, in a reflexive organization, what happens to the person driving the car when it runs out of gas? They're in trouble. And why are they in trouble? Because the week before when you were driving, and how did it work? It was fine. So we'll have a big center here and call you in. Right, I'm at general business. What's it like to have to find to the center about, so when you were driving the car the week before at Grand House? Grand fine. So when you handed the car back, it was, thanks for being with us. This is where the victims come from. Right, isn't it obvious that she caused this? Because all the evidence that it was fine until. Right. How many of you ever had this happen when you borrowed somebody's computer? And then they take it back? Right? Somehow it's not working, they look at you? How's that feel, right? That's the victim. So, what is the steam line you dug up? When it starts to leak, what will that be? Right? So what happens is we dig things up afterwards, and then it becomes a priority. But what was the priority the day before? Whatever was broken the day before. This becomes a priority when? After it breaks. Well, the president of Yale, I don't know if you met back in the late 80s when my wife and I lived close to Yale, was replacing steam lines and water lines across the Yale campus. Because he figured it was cheaper to replace them before they broke than after they broke. That's an efficient time to save time. But then you've got to have the wherewithal to work on things that are good. And who wants to do that? Because they have so many problems. That's a trap. All right, 1 + 1 = what? Another insight. Equals 2. Under what circumstances? Okay. So an apple is 2 apples, and a cup of water, and a cup of water is 2 cups of water. Additional work there. But if 7 different people in this organization with this flow of work each save $1,000, does the organization save $7,000? No, why not? The issue is, I think as you said, savings only add if the activities are independent. If just the parts are separate, if there's actually a connection, then savings don't add. So I explained to our daughter 2 years ago, when she was in 6th grade, what does 1 + 1 equal? She thought it was kind of a strange question. And I said, no, I asked people that question as part of that hour class. 4.5 hours one day, and one of the homework assignments for the next day is what does 1 + 1 equal? Under what conditions? So Allison gave me that look when she was in 6th grade. I said, Allison, I said, you and I each work at Taco Bell. We can each make 1 taco in an hour, and your taco stand's over there. My taco stand is over here. If we can each make 1 taco in an hour, then after 1 hour, how many tacos do we make? She said, 2. I said, how are we working? She said, separately. I said, what if we threw lettuce at each other? She said, well, then it would be less than 2. I said, what if while you did the shells, I got the hamburger, and while you did that, I got the lettuce? That was more than 2. That's teamwork. So addition is the absence of teamwork. Teamwork is when 2 people can do the work of 3, or 4, or 5. Anti-teamwork is when 5 are doing the work of 2. Right? But addition only works when the parts are independent. And how many of your organizations, people going around having cost-cutting exercises, and somebody says, let's add up the savings? Savings don't add if the activities are dependent. Right? And what happens is you end up saving money, but the money you save is actually makes the next person's life worse. And when we were part of Boeing, I heard a story where a guy in a similar exercise was trying to go fast, everybody go faster. And the guy at one point whose job was machine holes, and then later on somebody would put things in the hole. What he figured out, he could go a lot faster if after machining the hole, he didn't dever the hole, which is remove that sharp edge. So he got an award for going really fast, but the people downstream spent more time compensating for his savings than he saved, so it was a net negative. That's pretty easy to do. The alternative is to realize we can spend 1,000 here and 1,500 here and save 10,000 there. If we understand relationships, this is possible. So on the one hand, we can continue to have organizations that strive for savings across the board that don't act. Better than that is this type of leverage. So the leverage here comes from acting on things that aren't broken. That's the potential Deming is offering organizations. You think because you understand one, you must understand two, because one and one makes two. But you must also understand the and, which is what is the nature of the relationship. If it's no relationship, you have addition. If it's a negative relationship, it's negative synergy. And if it's a positive relationship, you have positive synergy. How important is customer satisfaction is another point of light. How important is customer satisfaction to this? Very important? How many of you say it's very important? It's actually highly overrated. Highly overrated. Highly overrated. Alright, I'm going to admit, this is customer disappointment. If you're the owner of the minivan, if you're owner of the tow truck, this is a really good day. So that the minivan, I don't know if you can identify, the minivan is made by whom? It's Toyota Sienna. People typically say, I'm not sure why, they typically say it looks like a Chrysler. It actually is a Toyota minivan, a Sienna, first model year 1998, and this was Christmas 1998, 10,000 miles later. My wife was driving, we're heading to see friends. Any idea where the photo was taken? People usually say the middle of nowhere. I said, no, it's 15 miles south of Bakersfield. Kind of the middle of nowhere. So disappointment is caused by what? Not meeting expectations. So the transmission failed at 10,000 miles. How many miles were we expecting? A lot more than that. The second transmission didn't see 90,000. That's pretty bad. Pretty bad. When I came across someone who worked at Toyota in Georgetown, Kentucky, where it was made, I met him at a semi-conference, and I found out he worked in Georgetown, and I said, my wife and I have a Sienna. He says, how do you like it? I said, the transmission failed at 10,000 miles. And I could tell by the look in his face, he knew exactly what I was saying. I was not the only one. So I got this look like, kind of smirk. I said, so tell me, what happened? He said, we tried to save a few pennies on a bearing. I said, you did. But what you saved cost us far more. Right. So disappointment is caused by expectations not being met. If that's the expectation, this is where we are, we're disappointed. What is it called when our expectations are met? Right? And what is it called when our expectations are exceeded? Now it's a different word. The common word is delight. And delight is more, satisfaction is meat, and disappointment is. So delight is when you put a dollar into a change machine and get 5 quarters back. How's that feel? And it's legal. Okay? Satisfaction is you put a dollar and get 4 quarters. How's that feel? Disappointment is you put a dollar and you get three quarters. How's that feel? You feel what? So disappointment is when we feel cheated, we got less than we expected. Satisfaction is when we get what we expect and we feel how? Can you give me a second? Stand up. Okay, give us that look. Okay, that's satisfaction. And delight? Yeah, okay. So who do you tell when you're delighted by a product or a service? In your personal life, who do you tell when you're delighted by a product or a service? Who do you tell when you're disappointed by a product or service? Okay, who do you tell when you're satisfied? That's why it's highly overrated. Right? You imagine a family reunion sometime this summer, and the email goes out, remember on Saturday, Sunday morning before we break up, we're going to go around the campfire and share a satisfaction story. You know the loaf of bread that tasted okay? Why is it that we think satisfaction is so important? I think we're so used to being disappointed that we'd be thrilled to break even. Right, everywhere I go, satisfaction, oh, that's outstanding. I go for the exercise, who do you tell? Nobody. So we have the feeling, good people say, well, delight's expensive. I said, yeah, keep thinking that. What does that say the way about the way your organizations operate? This is what Dr. Demi calls your daily style of management. We're handing off to the next person, handing off to the next person. What's the chance that the customer sees it's going to be delightful under those circumstances? Pretty slim. Okay. All right. So further, what letter grade is required for all the parts purchased in a Model T or a Maserati or a majority product out there? What's the letter grade required? Think letter grade. A, B, C, D, F. What do you think the letter grade requirement is? I asked this question for the first time. I'm a very senior NASA executive at NASA headquarters. We were owned by Boeing at the time, and I asked him what letter grade is required by Boeing and all the contracts for all the things that Boeing makes. He says A+. He said A+. I said the letter grade requirement is not A+. The letter grade requirement is not enough. And why is that the case? Because it's a pass-fail system. So if I hand off to you a letter grade D, what would you say? Did it meet requirements? Then you say, thank you. So then he can hand off a letter grade D to the next person. He will say, thank you. Alright? On a continuum, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, on a continuum, there is a difference. But in the world of pass-fail, everything which is good is equally good. That's the macro system model. All things that are good are equally good. So the reason we don't focus on things that are good is there's nothing to do. Because they're good. But on a continuum, you can work on an 80 to make it a 90. The only challenge is you have to explain to somebody that it's an 80, and then they'll say, but it's good. And you say, but it could be a 90. But it's good. And those are two different models of thinking. Category thinking says that good is bad. On a continuum, they're different. So we're not paying attention. We operate organizations because the quality folks are focusing on good versus bad. And the reason bad doesn't exist is that the organization cannot distinguish a 70 from an 80. We treat them as the same. Who notices the difference? Right, the difference shows up when they're put together. So these could be, the independent parts could each be A, B, C, and D. It doesn't come into account until we put it together. So if they remain in a box, no one will ever notice. But if the wing has to go on the airplane, then it will be noticed. Alright, how did you do on this test? So I asked a college student this question a few years ago. How many of you have been asked that question? At least once? Okay. So I asked this woman, she was a college freshman, and I said, well, in terms of an input-output diagram, you're the input, the grade is the output, and she said, okay. I said, what other inputs are there? And she said, my commitment. I said, okay, what other inputs are there? She said, how much energy I have. I said, well, what's another input? She couldn't think of any more. She got stuck. So I said, well, have you ever been in a situation where someone else in class asked a question and you learned from it? She said, no, it happens all the time. I said, well, that means other students are inputs. I said, now that you see that input, what other inputs are there? She said, my professor. I said, what else? She said, my brother. What else? My parents. I said, how many inputs are there? She said, there's an infinite number. I said, how come you got stuck at 2? She said, I was focusing on me. I said, well now, if all these other things are input, is the question still, how did you do on the test? Is that an appropriate question? Might the question need to be rephrased? To what? How did we do on the test? Because if I'm the professor and I ask, how did you do, what is the nature of our relationship? We're independent. I throw things out, if you can't hear it, then you're satisfying the thing. Only when I begin to understand that you're connected to me is it a we. That's teamwork. Sure then, as I throw them out there, yeah, the football leaves my hand, yeah, the information leaves my hand, your job to catch it, we are independent. Right? So in a, well, let's come back to this. Now we get back into the micro and the micro. So in the macro system model, which is all about parts, the belief is, if we follow the standard work, we'll always get a good part. Follow the standard work, get a good part, another good part, another good part, another good part. Right? If we get a bad part, now what? If something bad happens, and the car runs out of gas, we have to go find the root cause. We found her. Right? We're going to change policy, change procedures. That will never happen again. We found the root cause. And so in a macro system model, every time something bad happens, we launch an investigation, find the cause. There's only one. And then we fix it, we go on. Right? All the parts that are good are equally good. And we go to assembly, we put things together. Because they're good, they fit. Remember, you know, limited. But if they're good, then they'll fit. So that's the model. Now you get a wing, now you get a fuselage, and we put them together, they fit into the airplane, and when you turn it on, it works. There's the macro system model. So what's missing from this model? What's missing in this model? Follow the test to get a good part every time. When we get a bad part, we'll somebody screw it up, we'll change that. So what's missing in the model? Well, there's no need for collaboration. In this model, I hand off to the next guy, hands off to the next guy. It's just, you know, collaboration, and we're independent. We're getting the only feedback is the part we're good. I mean, so the people down here know the part comes from over here. But these people cannot complain to these people because these people are all giving out good parts. And there's something else. What's missing in this model? The what? No, the customer's going to receive the airplane. The customer's going to receive the rocket engine. But the problem with college students is, right, there's this expression, you have no two snowflakes on the same. Right? So that's the thing under some variation. If variation exists, then the parts that are good can't be easily good. So what's missing in the model is this model has no variation. This model says everything that's good is equally good. On a continuum, a quarter of a tank and a full tank are different. In this model, in both cases, the car has gas. See, if you talk about are the requirements met, it's yes or no. So a few years ago, we went bowling as a family. And after going bowling along the master bedroom, my wife's bowling ball was in the doorway. So I thought it was a strange place for it. So after I was there, she said she had asked Wilson, who was 13 at the time, to put it away. Asked Wilson, so I called Wilson over. I said, "Why is the bowling ball here?" And he said, and I quote, "Mom said put it in the bedroom." Did he meet requirements? Yeah, he met requirements. Can I complain? That's not in this model. So where does the effect of the bowling ball ending up in the doorway show up in this model? Bowling ball plays in the doorway there. Where does that effect get shown? Shows up in assembly. So can the assembly person complain? No. So what we have in this organization are people compensating, and they think banging it together is the norm. It feels because they're not A's, we're banging them together, but you can't challenge people on the street because all the parts are good. That's the model. Alright, let me say what we're doing at Rocket Language is different than that, what we all do at home. Let's say you're in the garage, you're working in the garage at home on a woodworking project. Yeah, you're building a set of cabinets. You have a piece of wood. You want it to be cut to a given length. How many lines will you draw? Let's say you want to make a cut somewhere in the vicinity of this laser pointer. How many lines will be drawn vertically across that piece of wood before you make the cut when you're working on this at home? Great. In the vicinity of that, if you want to cut it to be 4 inches long, how many lines will be on the top face? How many people draw one line? So at 4 years old, Wilson, same one I just mentioned, at 4 years old, we're in the garage, and Wilson drew a fairly crooked one line on the piece of wood, and I thought, his earliest demonstrations of cutting a piece of wood are to draw one line. Everyone I work with goes home and does that. How normal is that? To draw one line. You think the rocket scientists I work with could say, "Hey, that's a foreign concept." No, it's pretty natural at home. Right, we call that a target. How many of you at home have ever drawn two lines of a piece of wood wider than the width of the blade and then said, "Cut anywhere in between, it doesn't matter"? You ever do that at home? But that's what we do at work. And those two lines are called tolerances. And so I asked the guy once, he says, "Why at home do you aim for the line and then at work anywhere in between?" He's a machinist. And his answer was so profound, he says, "Because at home I cut wood and at work I cut metal." I said, "Well, who designed it at home?" He did. Right? Who bought the pieces of wood at home? He did. Who cut them all out? He did. Who did final assembly? Same guy. Who lives with it? Same guy. That's teamwork. Who designs it at work? You do, right? Who buys it? So at work, we give everybody a set of requirements. And then who decides what the letter grade is at work? If somebody gives you a set of requirements to meet, who decides that the letter grade you're delivering to the next person is an A, B, C, or D? Who makes that decision? Who? No, you do. Right? You get to hand off to him an A, B, C, or D. Every day you decide, And can the person downstream get angry over that? Not sure they can. Can they do anything about it? Can they go to your boss and complain? Not in the macro system model, because you're meeting requirements. Right? So in Rocket Science, can we complain if a supplier leaves a bowling ball in the doorway? No. He'll say, not only do we meet the requirements, we met your requirements. And if you didn't want the bowling ball in the doorway, you should have changed the requirements. All right, we'll see how that goes. So the micro system model includes variation, and it takes into account that everything within spec is different. And so when it comes to good, they're not equally good, there's actually degrees of good, degrees of fit, degrees of fit, there's actually variability. And the variability is, the closer you are to the line, the easier it is to assemble, and the farther away. So that variation in assembly is coming from the parts. But in a macro system model, we don't need a connection. We just say, The parts are good, so let's just use a hammer. I'm not against tolerances, but tolerances create requirements and that might create a set of behaviors. So we ask a machine that's machining a hole, to machine a hole between a min and a max, min and max, where is it likely the machinist will machine the hole across that range? Any guess? My finest, it's likely the machinist is going to make the hole on the small side. Right? Why is that the case? You can always become bigger. The machine is starting off small, becoming progressively larger, and why does she stop there? Because she can. Maybe she's getting paid to make 1,000 holes. This is like something that, like, you know, as soon as you're given a quota of 1,000 holes, you're thinking faster is better. For who? For you. Alright, term paper. Let's say the term paper requirement is 20 to 25 pages. What's going to happen here? Right? Let's go back to manufacturing. The average diameter must be between the min and the max. But now the average diameter starts out on the large side. Right? So the average diameter is going to start off large and they remain progressively smaller. So what do you think is going to happen? Just inside. Any chance of going further? No. And the last example here, a friend told her son, take the lollipop outside. So how far do you think he was from the door to 100 feet into the backyard? And to blow and blow in the doorway, Jacob met the requirement. So what behavior do you see going on here? This is everyone doing the minimum. Alright, so what allows that? As long as we define requirements and aren't thinking, this is what, right, I mean, how likely is it that everyone's going to go out and do this? And we wonder why delight doesn't happen? We wonder why satisfaction doesn't happen? What are the behaviors we're getting? The deal is we are not interchangeable parts. But in a macro system world, it wouldn't matter what we did because they are interchangeable. That's the macro system world. In the macro system world, you follow instructions, and if you don't, I'll find someone who will. And I just beat you up on meeting requirements, right? And in that world, you're as interchangeable as what you're making. So I'm just yanking you, put another person in, manage with fear, drive you to create these numbers. And all you're doing is making it worse for others, and that's why I don't chase them and fire them too. Deming viewed the organization as interdependent. As soon as we follow the world of requirements, we're missing interdependence. Requirements have a belief of independence. Okay. Now, let's think about that chart. In an interview organization where people are very, very aware of what I'm sharing with you, now, the trip report, and just do it as a group. In an organization where people are aware of what I'm sharing with you, what's the organization going to look like physically? Could be smaller, what else? So what do you see in the organization that signifies we understand relationships, we understand interdependence? But what does teamwork look like? Physically, what's it going to look like? See, with people, you're going to see collaboration. But in the physical environment, what will you see as a telltale sign of these people understand thinking together? What will be a telltale? What physical sign would you see in the organization that tells you that? What do you have to say? Here's what people say, lack of boundaries. A sense of oneness.
Okay.
What are you going to see in a reflective organization? You're going to see a lot of silence. All right, what about people in a reflective organization? What are you going to see there? In a reflective organization, What will you see, people-wise?
Finger-pointing.
Hmm? Finger-pointing. So the hallway conversations will sound like what? Right? But Trisha, I think, you know, our department delivered on time. But what about that department? So will you hear a lot of love from them? Alright? In an in-thinking organization, what will you see? People want. Now you're getting collaboration.
Okay.
Point is that the difference between these organizations has to do with their understanding of how things connect or not. In one space, I believe everything is interdependent, which means if I deliver a D minus to you, it's going to come back. So why would I do that? Versus a belief that I can get away with that. This is a set of answers from a given class. It's over here, they saw clean and well-maintained. Over here, unorganized. Over here, two-line thinking, which is focusing on tolerances. Over here, open lines of communication. And wherever I go do this exercise, the answers are all the same. And I'll ask those people, what percent of organizations are reflective? What do you think? This is an academic called prevailing style of management. And so this unscientific survey since 1998, when I asked people what percent are on the right, people say the majority. Well, how can there be so many companies running that way? What keeps them in business? It's lousy competition. The academic would say, no one can do you so much harm as a lousy competitor. If you had a good competitor, you wouldn't be able to survive. You'd have to... Right. So now that the quality focus on the right-hand side is not on par, it's on relationships. The goal focus is not on defect-free parts. It's about how do we spend money to make money. The left-hand side is scrapping rework. The right-hand side is looking for where's the next relationship we could leverage? Where's an ounce of prevention going to give us a pound of cure? The right-hand side, this is leadership. We are proactive. The skills are process control and systemic solutions. The impact, we have continuous investment in long-lasting relationships. And physical attributes, there are physical handoffs and no mental handoffs. So left-hand side, we mind part, and the right-hand side, we mind the gap. So here's the explanation of what's behind all this. So we have two modes of thinking. We have category thinking, good parts, bad parts. You put things in categories, they're viewed as absolute. Discrete, it's like time being digital. Things are black and white, one or the other. Good, bad, up, down. On the right-hand side, we have continuum thinking. That's what a gas gauge gives us, on a continuum. So on a gas gauge, everything is relative. There's no stress. There are no lines. You have wholeness. It's analog time as opposed to digital time. You have shades of gray. You have better and fast. A lot of people, you know, so why do we focus on bad to make them good? Why don't we work on the good? I get to look at people like, work on the good? Well, the reason I get to look at it, better does not exist. So why would you work on the good? There is no better. Well, on the right-hand side, better exists. The better only exists in a microsystem world. Then we can create more and more categories. I'm not against categories. The proposal is, let's better understand which mode of thinking we're using. Dr. Kish's work, I found out before Deming. Kish's work says, there is that target value on the piece of wood at home. Kish's model is, if the piece of wood at home is a little bit longer, then it's going to cause loss, which is extra effort, but to who? At home it's six. So at home, when it's a little bit longer, I feel the impact, so I strive to be on target because it's easy for me. At work, who feels the impact? Somebody else. So the Gucci's model is that the longer it is, the more work, the shorter it is, the more work. So the reason I focus on target is, makes my life easier. And then we go to work, and then we'll leave in the red line, and we start to say, well, it doesn't really matter anymore. So in a macro system world, these three distributions would all deliver the same results. And in microsystem world, we have variation, we understand that difference. Dr. Deming spoke a lot about the need for transforming. Transforming involves moving from observer to participant, from witness to participant, moving from part to part of spectating to spectating, which is contrasting from reforming, which is a bunch of physical change. And it's not that organizations should not have physical change, but which of these physical changes is going to cause me as a quarterback to realize that the wide receiver's ability to catch it depends on my ability to throw. And so Deming's work was heavily on the right-hand side. Nothing wrong with physical change, but what's it going to take to shift our focus and understand that we are connected to others, not separate from others? And so the present state is a lot of reflexive organizations where we are highly reactive and then operate the lower level. Future state organizations, this concept of in-thinking, so where at Rocketdyne we've been using this phrase as an explanation for the integration of Deming's work and other work. The concept of in-thinking derives from awareness of our thinking and the assumptions we make and how we act when allocating resources. Our thinking is defined as a way of reasoning. Fundamental to the resource allocation is our activity, proactive or reactive, and other resources line or out. And thinking advises individuals to learn to perceive patterns of interdependencies, not independencies, interdependencies, and to use that to judge. Then we end up with resource management, which is purposeful, which means that there's a lot of thought going into efficient time and save time. And so not only would we operate on the right-hand side with a great sense of ownership as ours, but we would be purposely proactive or purposely reactive. And that, what's behind purposely is that there's some things that are okay to break and then we replace them, like the light bulb in the kitchen. And there's some things like the smoke alarm battery that we would replace beforehand. So it's nothing wrong with being reactive, but it's a choice. And so this gives rise to the reflective and the purposeful. Present state organizations, we drive change, driving changes, like driving cars, driving cattle. The employees don't have much of a choice. To see, you will do this, in which case you respond to.
Sure.
This was one of the longest lessons are. So we focus on reforming a lot of physical change, we reduce costs, we think additional work, we talk about teamwork, strive to zero defect, zero waste, satisfaction, talk about improvement, to use metrics for alignment. An alternate approach where Deming is coming from is leading transformation, where each of us play a role in trying to understand that our work affects others. Then the idea is, can we become the change we want to see in others? Use reforming and transforming. We have resource and relationship management. We think and learn together, then work together. We manage customers' expectations as opposed to thinking satisfaction is all we have to do. We realize that now and then we might want to offer delight. Nothing wrong with satisfaction. Everything cannot be delightful. We don't have the resources. So we're finding out what aspect will be delightful, everything else will be satisfactory, and some things currently will have to be disappointing. We have to manage that relationship. Continuous investment, sufficient time to save time, and then we use the thinking of our thinking to align our efforts. And so my hope is that by the time we get to this list, you appreciate that most of the organizations that such people as these are presenting were people coming from a reflective environment, talked about part, quality was about part. And so how they took this list was radically different than an in-thinking organization. Okay. In an in-thinking organization, which I have to drive out here, right? Would you have to break down barriers between departments? Right? Would you have, right, in the practice of awarding a price tag on business? See, in the world of interchangeable parts, we go to the cheap doctors, not the expensive doctors, because, you know, they're all the same. In an in-thinking model, you realize that doctors are actually different. Right? Work standard, you know, how many holes in the machine as opposed to, wait a minute, wait a minute. You know, let's spend more money on the hole. Let's take the time to make the whole directions, we're going to save the money in assembly. And the idea of putting everyone to work, the transformation is everyone's job. So Dr. Deming, in his last book, and even to back up, he started off with the 14 points, that was 1982-83 time frame, and he kept looking for a better explanation of what he was trying to say, because what he was saying was not being heard. And so in his last book, and that's the video on Deming you can find, he said we need to have appreciation of the system that our activities are connected, not disconnected, knowledge about variation, that things are different, in terms of the psychology, as somebody pointed out to me once, that psychology stuff, that only applies when there are people involved.
Yeah.
So if you didn't have people in the system, you don't have to worry about psychology. Alright, the theory of knowledge piece is that everything we do is based on a theory, and a theory is a prediction of the future with a chance of being wrong. And so we base our work on theories, we can learn, and we base our work on laws, and there's no learning, because laws are guarantees of the future. So what Deming is saying is, we need to have these four connected in order to really change our organization. The aim of this from the chapter 4 of the economic, revealing style of management, that's the reflective environment, must undergo transformation, a system cannot understand itself. Transformation requires an outside view. The aim of the chapter, the aim of this exposure, is to provide an outside view, and then they call that system a lens, a system of profound knowledge. It provides a lens that provides a map of a theory by which to understand the organizations in which we work. The first step is transformation of the individual. This transformation is discontinuous. It comes from an understanding of a system of profound knowledge. The individual transform will perceive new meaning to life, to events, to interactions, to number of interactions between people. Once the individual understands the system of profound knowledge, he can apply this principle in every kind of relationship with others and on the basis for judging his own decisions and transmission of the organization. One need not be eminent in any or all four parts. Right? So it's not enough to have a statistician. You want to bring these things together as a system. And I guess three times that day that I saw Deming speak, he made this quote. All that we have comes from people who are responsible only to themselves. Right? In a reflective organization, no one has to do anything other than the minimum. And anything beyond that is something they personally decide to do. And so his impression was everything that we have comes from people that, in spite of that system, decided to do more. There we go.
Okay, I think in the interest of time, we're going to go ahead and move on. I'm sure that if you have any questions.